Hello there, golf fans, and welcome to a special U.S. Open preview here on Musings on Golf. My name is Kelly Elbin, and along with my buddy Bob Bupka, we'll help you get ready for the 124th edition of the National Championship of American Golf to be contested over the masterpiece that Donald Ross created, the number two course at Pinehurst Resort in the Sand Hills of North Carolina. Robert, it truly is an open championship. And it's certainly great to have the doors being opened to Gary Koch to once again be in the broadcast booth for NBC Sports. It's going to be a great week. And Gary Koch was a great interview, Bob.
Certainly is a great honor to have Gary Koch. I've respected this guy for a long time. Matter of fact, you'll hear in the interview, I kid him a little bit about the picture that was taken when he won in Las Vegas. And before we even go any further, I know you just landed from Las Vegas. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of your trip in Vegas.
Okay, so it was a nice mix of golf and what turned out to be the greatest single performance I've ever seen live. Had two great rounds of golf at Cascada on Saturday. What a neat, incredible mountain layout that is. Just the vistas there. And then really had a fun time at TPC Las Vegas yesterday. This is Tuesday as we record this, Bob. And the primary reason for going out there, I am the farthest thing from being a deadhead. But let me tell you something. Dead and Company, they're in residence right now at the Sphere in Las Vegas. You got to see it to believe it. It's with my buddies, Danny Calori and Barry Reese. We had an incredible time. It was easily, I mean, these guys played for 3 hours and 40 minutes. Bob Weir, John Mayer. I mean, just the visuals of the place. It was an unparalleled performance in my lifetime. It was one of the coolest things I've ever been part of.
So you would say, beyond any question of a doubt, the single best, I don't even know what to say, auditorium or
yeah. 19,000, it holds 19,000, the Sphere.
Wow.
And the way the visuals are presented, everything is, it goes beyond you, around you. It's not just something that you see with some visuals down by the stage. It's the future is here in terms of incredible presentations, and they sounded great. They are great. One of the things about the Grateful Dead, any of those bands like that, Bob, these guys as musicians, off the charts. You love great guitars, you know, drums, etc. It's a hefty investment, well worth it.
So what a show we got ready for listeners of Musings on Golf this week. Not only are we going to talk about Pinehurst, we're going to talk about Gary Koch. We mentioned him already, one of the best guys out there. And we have something really special, Kelly, for our listeners on Musings on Golf. They'll not be able to hear this anywhere else. And I'm going to let you introduce it.
Well, when we think about Pinehurst and the U.S. Open, at least I do, Payne Stewart comes to mind immediately. And, man, I know our collective hearts were just torn apart when he died in that awful plane crash. And, Bob, after Payne's remarkable win at the number two course in 1999, you had this opportunity to go face-to-face with the new U.S. Open champion.
Never in the history of a U.S. Open has anybody ever played a better three closing holes. Your emotions right now, Payne?
Well, I don't know what I'm feeling. I'm pretty numb right this second. I'm very proud of myself. But it's going to take me a day or so to get over and kind of analyze what just happened to me. It's beyond comprehension right this second.
Payne Stewart, after you finished second last year, you vowed that you were going to get yourself in position this year and you were going to give it your best to close the deal. Making statements like that and executing them is just an incredible accomplishment.
Well, thank you. It's a wonderful feeling. I think that I'm going to enjoy this time a lot more than I enjoyed the first one. I know how to enjoy and relish in my accomplishment. And last time in 91, I don't think I understood that.
When you win the US Open once, you're a true champion. When you win it twice, you're a great champion in golf history. How much sweeter is number two than number one?
Well, it's very sweet. It's it's another dream come true. I don't know that I ever, I believed in myself and I believed that I was capable of doing it. But until you do it, you just never know.
Payne, you also had another objective this year that you even shared with your wife, Tracy. You vowed that you wanted to be on the U.S. Ryder Cup team. Knowing this victory here is going to put you there, how does it feel to know you're a part of that team?
Well, I will be looking very forward to that. It's that is probably more pressure than what I just dealt with because we don't own that cup and we need to. So I'm going to do my best to help the other 11 guys and our captain bring it back to the United States.
Congratulations, 1999 United States Open champion, Payne Stewart, and how sweet does it sound?
It sounds really good. I can't really understand it right this second, but it sounds really good.
Well, it breaks my heart just to hear that, Kelly, because it wasn't but a few short months after that we lost Payne, a good friend, in that horrific plane crash.
Bob, he had really, I would imagine having that opportunity to literally be right next to him not long after he had, made that putt at 18 and held Mickelson off by a shot. Having that chance to sit with him, for you had to be a really cool experience. I've got to believe he seemed rather under control, but it had to be an extraordinarily jubilant guy at that time, right?
Oh, he certainly was. I was bubbling up over the opportunity just
Yeah.
speak to him. He had become somewhat of a friend over the years, somebody that I really admired. I liked him as a family guy. I loved him as a golfer. He was cocky, sure, but his golf stood up to any of the cockiness he displayed. And still to this day, can't believe that we lost him in that tragic plane crash.
As he was at the top of his game then, right now we've got Scottie Scheffler, Bob, who is, I haven't seen anything like this in quite some time. I don't even know what kind of pace you call it, a torrid pace. He seems to win virtually every time out. And now he heads into Pinehurst, just as he did heading into Valhalla with a victory. And I know it meant an awful lot to him to win at Jack's course at the Memorial Tournament presented by Workday. And let's hear what Scotty had to say about winning at a very, very special place.
Mr. Nicklaus did a lot of great things for the game of golf, but the effect he had on his community and our country as well is very special. And so I've looked up to him for a long time. Yeah, it's special to be here, and it's even more special to be the winner. I like how my game's feeling right now. I feel like I've been playing some good golf. It's great to see some results too and wins. And out here the margins are so small between winning and losing, and it's a putt or a shot here or there. And fortunately today I was able to hit the shots when I needed to. To choose this life as a golfer is not for, I would say a normal person. I think we all got a few screws loose to play this game professionally and just battling week in, week out. And I think that's really part of the fun of it. So I'll look back fondly on today being the battle that it was. Colin was playing some really good golf. He hit a lot of quality shots today. And yeah, he was a tough man to beat for sure.
Absolutely incredible what Scottie Scheffler is doing right now. I mean, every time you step back, you say he can't do it again, but he does do it again. And he just recently became a father. He's a wonderful human being. He's what I call one of our outstanding ambassadors for the game of golf. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And how about this one? I get a kick. I mean, I've heard for many years that the Irish, they love to party. Well, Bob McIntyre wins the Canadian Open. He's eligible to play in Jack's tournament at Muirfield. Oh, no, not for Bob McIntyre. Back to Scotland. And I understand the party lasted 2, maybe 3 days. He was just so happy with that Canadian Open, and he did it with his father on the bag, made it extra special.
Very much so. And while he has, while Bob has returned to the States to play at the U.S. Open, Doogie, his dad slash caddy, stays behind, stays back in Scotland, and he's gonna Bob's gonna use a caddy he's had a few times, but one for one with his dad on the bag. It's pretty darn good. Hey, Bob, you've covered the U.S. Open at Pinehurst, number two. It's an anchor site now for the USGA. There are going to be many more U.S. Opens down the road. There's been several already. What stands out? The greens, the domed turtleback shape of the greens certainly define that golf course. What are your recollections and thoughts on number two? And what makes it so special?
Well, it always was special. Anything designed by Donald Ross puts it in a category of its own. And then Ben Crenshaw, Bill Kaur, came in recently, just really changed the look of the place. You know, the whole key to Pinehurst number two are the greens. I mean, people say they're, you know, like turtlebacks. And, you know, you can hit a good shot. It rolls up near the hole, but then it keeps going and going. Next thing, it's off the green and you have no shot. So it's definitely a second shot golf course. You know, driving it far, not necessarily a big advantage. So I think Rory McIlroy and Bryson DeChambeau, a couple of guys that hit it 9 million miles, might not have the advantage that they would have on another golf course, Kelly, because once you're in the fairway, everything's equal. And once you get up around the greens, you know, last time Martin Keimer played here, he used a putter exclusively off the greens and ran away with the thing. And I think you're going to see a lot of putts from off the greens, you know, this year. And, you know, Kelly, I think it's going to be a lot easier for the players using a putter to get it close to the hole than it was for you to get closer to 21 while you were playing blackjack in Vegas.
I had to bring that up. I knew that was coming. You're absolutely spot on, unfortunately. So that pinpoint accuracy, great iron play is going to, I got to tell you what, you know, Scheffler held off Xander Schauffele the week before the PGA Championship, and then Schauffele won at Valhalla. Scheffler holds off Colin Morikawa the week before the United States Open Golf Championship. Colin Morikawa is a great iron player as well. I expect him to be right there. Certainly, Scotty is going to be really, really hard to beat. But yeah, I think you're that what you're talking about with the putting from way off the green at times, it kind of harkens back to what you typically would see in an Open Championship, Bob, with those putts from, you know, 100 feet off the green and so forth. But you miss the greens here a little bit. You got to be really creative with the next shot you hit just to try to make some pars.
You know, Pinehurst number two is a resort golf course. It's open to the general public. And I recommend to any one of our Musings on Golf listeners, if they have the opportunity, tee it up on Pinehurst number two. You'll have a golfing experience like you've never, ever had before. It is simply incredible to play.
Hey, a few things before we get to Gary Koch, Bob. I was watching the third round, or maybe it was, I guess maybe it was the final round of the Memorial, and I noticed that Jack Nicklaus was getting very emotional, and the reason was that they were looking ahead to next year when his beloved wife, Barbara, is going to be the honoree at the 2025 Memorial, and that list of honorees is extensive and famous when it comes to golf, but no one's meant more to Jack in his life professionally than Barbara, who they're going to honor next year. It's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, it certainly was a rare sight to see Jack Nicklaus breaking down with tears running down his cheeks. But why not? Barbara Nicklaus, who was kind enough to be one of our guests on Musings on Golf, and we loved every minute of it. She is easily the first lady of golf, has done so much for Jack's career, for her family. Everything about Barbara Nicklaus is as good as it gets. That's the only way you can say it. And I'm thrilled to death that Barbara Nicklaus next year is going to be the honoree at the 2025 Memorial. And I guarantee you, as Jack introduces her next year, there will not be a dry eye in the house.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And they were, I'm sure, very few dry eyes as well earlier this week with the World Golf Hall of Fame honoring Padraig Harrington, inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame, Sandra Palmer, the late Tom Weisskopf, Johnny Farrell, long overdue into the World Golf Hall of Fame. And then the remaining seven LPGA founders, as they've been identified, inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. An interesting grouping and all very well-deserved. You know, Padraig in particular to me, Bob, I just so unheralded, such a hardworking guy, always trying to figure out a way to get better. Really, really personally happy for Padraig Harrington that he's in the World Golf Hall of Fame. He's just a great individual and one heck of a player.
Absolutely. And to be inducted by his son, Paddy, who's a clone of Padraig, I mean, it was special. I mean, his son did an outstanding job, and certainly Padraig Harrington deserves to be in the Hall of Fame as popular a player that's ever put a peg in the ground.
Couldn't agree with you more. Hey, by the way, really cool, and we're going to catch up with this guy later on. Rhett Evans, the CEO of the Golf Course Superintendents Association, was a guest of ours several months ago, and in fact, that was before he went on the long voyage to try to reach the summit of Mount Everest. Bob, he did it. And a great social media following on that. And Rhett, he said it was a life-changing experience in a text that I had back and forth with him. He's going to be joining us as a guest real soon and looking forward to hearing what obviously will be a remarkable story for Rhett Evans. Hey, before we go to Gary Cook, real quick, one other remarkable story. And this is what kind of makes the U.S. Open so cool. Bob, you remember Pat McGowan, who played on tour. Pat married the daughter of Peggy Kirk Bell, who along with Peggy Kirk Bell and her husband really took this resort called Pine Needles, not far from Pinehurst, and made it into a world-class facility. He's hosted major championships. Well, Michael McGowan, her grandson, and unfortunately Peggy Kirk Bell's passed away. Michael McGowan will hit the first drive at the U.S. Open on Thursday. This is a guy who got into the qualifying seven-man playoff for the last six spots at Dallas Athletic Club. He grew up literally down the road. As I mentioned, his dad, Pat McGowan, won twice on tour. But he also lost his own mom to pancreatic cancer at age 68 about a year or so ago. So I would imagine the emotions for Michael McGowan to be able to hit the shot. He's a professional, by the way, to hit the very first shot. I mean, you talk about a fairy tale, Bob. It's a wonderful, lovely story.
What an honor. What an honor. What a deserving honor. I mean, I knew Peggy Bell very well. Annika Sorenstam won a women's open there. We were deeply involved in that one. And Pine Needles, you know, it's not Pinehurst number two. But I'll guarantee you, anybody that plays Pine Needles is not going to complain about anything. Just an outstanding place to play 18 holes of golf.
Well, and nobody's going to be complaining. In fact, everybody should be celebrating the fact that Gary Koch is back behind the mic at the U.S. Open, Bob. Not really sure NBC Sports did the right thing the way they really, really unheralded way of letting he and Roger Maltby go in the fall of 2022. Gary had been with the network for 25 years, but they were invited back for the 50th anniversary of the Players and a lot of excited people for that. And now Gary's going to be sitting alongside our buddy Steve Sands doing some analysis of a lot of the early play. It was great to hear his voice, Bob, and he may be off the mic or had been off the mic for a year and a half, but boy, does he know the game. And I know he's so pumped to be at Pinehurst number two.
All right, we're going to be right back with Gary Koch. But first, some important messages from our proud sponsors of Musings on Golf.
Like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry. Celebrating its 30th year, the South Florida PGA Golf Pass offers the ultimate summer golf experience with special access to more than 100 private, semi-private, and public golf facilities. From May 1st through October 31st, Golf Pass members can enjoy special low rates, exclusive member-only outings, special offers, and more. For just $60, you can purchase the South Florida PGA Golf Pass and instantly gain access to all these great benefits through the member-only app. It's simple. Pay, download, play. Visit sfpgagolf.com/golfpass for more information. That's sfpgagolf.com/golfpass.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Bob, 2 days from now, the 124th United States Open Golf Championship officially begins at famed Pinehurst No. 2 in North Carolina. Viewers will get to see more than 200 hours of coverage this week through NBC Sports, Peacock, and USA Network. And for the 1,000th championship conducted by the United States Golf Association, they will once again hear from and see a great friend of the game. He will serve as an analyst with Steve Sands, and what a thrill it is for all of us. Barry Koch, welcome back to the booth at the U.S. Open, and welcome to Musings on Golf.
Well, thank you very much, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be with you and Bob here the week of the U.S. Open. And certainly one of my favorite championship venues, Pinehurst No. 2. You know, it presents some very unique challenges for the best players in the world. And I, for one, can't wait to see how they were able to handle it.
How you doing, Gary? I couldn't make it down to Pinehurst. But in preparation, I think I did the next best thing. I'm only yards from the front entrance to Shinnecock. And Shinnecock is one of the outstanding U.S. Open golf courses in the country.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. In fact, I was fortunate enough to play a couple of U.S. Opens there. It certainly has a very warm place in my heart, and I know several of the members there, so I've had an opportunity to play it numerous other times. And of all the golf courses out there on Long Island, and there are a lot of great ones, Bob, Shinnecock's my favorite.
I remember back in 1981 when they decided they were going to come to Shinnecock in 86. Nobody really knew of Shinnecock, but after that first U.S. Open, everybody did. Let me ask you a question, Gary. Is my picture still hanging in your office?
Yeah, Bob, it is still there. That's how far back we go, buddy.
Yeah.
Well wait a minute. Let's get to the root of this. What is this all about, Mr. Bucca?
Well, Gary prevailed out in Las Vegas, won the tournament. There are a lot of pictures taken, and I happened to be standing in the background, and it was a picture that Gary really liked. He put it up in his office, and I've been under pressure ever since.
Right place, right time, Bob.
Yeah, it's an honor to be in your office. That's for sure. And oh, wait a minute. Okay, I need some help here.
It's okay. Yeah, you want me to handle it?
Yeah, you started out then, Kel.
Yeah, hey Gary. Obviously, I mentioned that you are back in the booth. I know you've got to be excited for that. Could you please explain to our listeners, you know, the announcing teams for this U.S. Open through NBC Sports, a little different than some of the other networks are handling it. How will that play out in terms of the different teams over the course of the four rounds?
Well, Kelly, I think it'll be interesting. Obviously, Sam Flood, the executive producer at NBC Sports, who's now in charge of all the golf telecasts, has come up with this new idea of having a four-person booth, so two play-by-play guys and two analysts. One set will cover the odd holes. The other set will cover the even holes. It seems to allow for perhaps a little bit more conversation amongst the analysts and certainly the play-by-play guys. I think it also gives the guys on the ground, the foot soldiers, maybe a little bit more time to talk because it's easier to get it down to them. You've eliminated one step of having to go through a tower announcer to get down to the guys on the ground. You mentioned I'll be teamed with Steve Sands. I think Brandel Chamblee will be with Dan Hicks. I think Brad Faxon will be with Mike Tirico. There'll be some other pairings as well, which I haven't seen yet. And my role will be mainly a setup man. I'll be the long reliever. I'll be in before the ace closers come in. I believe Steve and I will be on, I want to say, from 9 to 2:30 on Thursday and Friday, from 10 to 3 on Saturday, and 9 to 2 on Sunday. So it'll certainly give us a chance, especially the first 2 days, to see all the players in the field, which will be great. And then come the weekend, we'll be a little bit more of what I would term the setup guys. We'll be able to take a look at how the golf course is playing, maybe look for some trends on certain holes, certain hole locations, and hopefully give everybody a preview as to what to expect once the last groupings go off later in the day.
Well, I just want to say that you delighted golf fans everywhere with rehooking up with your old buddy Roger Maltby. What was it like to be back on the air at the Players? And when did NBC let you know they wanted both of you for the U.S. Open?
Well, Bob, you know, it was great being back at the Players, no question about it. One of my favorite events that that NBC has broadcast for a long period of time. I was involved in every telecast there since 1997. So certainly a lot of that time spent calling the 17th hole, the infamous Island Green. So it was great. It was a lot of fun. It allowed me to see a lot of old, what I'd call teammates that I had not been with for probably, you know, a little over a year. You keep in touch with people, but it's not quite the same not seeing them face to face. So it allowed me to do that, allowed me to reconnect with some of the players and some of the instructors and some of the teachers and officials and so forth and so on. So a very enjoyable week. Obviously, the social media seemed to really enjoy having Roger and I back. There were a lot of very positive comments and articles written. And I think that maybe prompted NBC to you know, think about having Roger and I be a part of the U.S. Open telecast as well. I would say it was about 2 months ago that I actually received the call saying that you know, they'd love to have me be a part of it, which, again, having already called 3 U.S. Opens for NBC at Pinehurst number 2, 99, 2005, and also 2014, to have the opportunity to be involved in a fourth U.S. Open telecast there at Pinehurst number 2 was a great honor. And I look forward to a really fun week.
Give us a little insight. What should our listeners expect to see in terms of the demands of Pinehurst number 2? It has quite a reputation. And has the golf course changed much since Martin Kaymer won there a decade ago?
Bob, not really. I would say, let me answer the second part of your question first. It doesn't seem as though the golf course has changed a tremendous amount. You know, it was 2010 when Bill Coar and Ben Crenshaw came in and kind of did the restoration of all the wasty sand areas with the love grass and all that. And that's still a very prominent part of the play of the golf course. You have to keep the ball out of those areas. So, you know, driving will be important, no question about it. But when I think of Pinehurst number 2, I think of two things. One, a second shot golf course. You're playing to these famous Donald Ross greens that I have always equated to like a turtle shell. You know, kind of high in the middle, and a lot of times they fall off on every side. So the effective area that you're playing to with your approach shots is very small on a number of these greens. So, you know, you're going to have to be very precise with your iron play. And then because of the way the greens are designed and the roll-off areas, you're going to be faced with a lot of different short game shots. And the cool thing about Pinehurst number 2 to me is that it allows for a lot of different types of shots around the greens. You'll see some guys, Martin Kaymer, for example, in 14, putted virtually every single time he missed the green. You'll see other guys playing chip and run shots with maybe 7-8 irons. You'll be some of the players will be trying to hit flop shots off some very tight Bermuda grass lies. So it should be a fascinating week watching their play around the greens and into the greens as well.
Well, we're delighted to be joined by Gary Koch, who returns to covering the U.S. Open this week at Pinehurst number 2. Hey, Gary, Payne Stewart won at Pinehurst in obviously very dramatic fashion in 1999. And then he was gone just a few months later. You were the recipient of the Payne Stewart Award last year. I'm sure it was special. I know the tour kind of sets you up in a good way for that award. Could you talk a little bit about that good setup and also what you recall about Payne himself and that incredible win some 25 years ago?
First of all, I had no idea I'd been nominated for the Payne Stewart Award. So that was probably the one of the reasons why the surprise. I got a call from PGA Tour Productions, one of the people there that I had worked with numerous times through the years. And they said they were getting ready to start working on a video for the 50th anniversary of the Players. And that I had played in numerous Players Championships. I'd been on the broadcast since 1997. They would like to come down to my house, sit down and do a kind of a sit down interview and kind of just talk about some of the things that I had seen happen or the golf course and that type thing. So of course I bit hook, line and sinker, thinking, well, that makes sense. You know, I can see that. So the film crew shows up at the house, they get all set up. We're in the living room. I've got this lady asking me all these questions. I'm totally into it, telling stories and so forth and so on. About that time, my front door opens and Tracy Stewart walks in, and it was just an absolute shock. I mean, obviously I knew exactly why she was there once she walked in the door, but, you know, to have her actually come to my house, and be the one to present me with the Payne Stewart Award and to know that I was going to be receiving it, was really very special. She's a special lady. And come to find out later that was the first time she'd ever done it in person. Usually the recipient was notified by a phone call from Tracy. So it made it even more special. What do I remember from 99 when Payne won? Well, I was in a tower behind the 16th green. That Sunday was cool and misty and really not a very nice day to play golf. 16th hole was a par 4, extremely long. It was a converted par 5, as the USGA likes to do. I want to say my stat guy had handed me a note right before the last few groups arrived at 16, saying that only 5% of the field had hit the green in regulation on that Sunday. That's how difficult the par 4 was. Payne hit two shots just short of the green, and then a very, by his standards, poor pitch shot. Tried to run the ball up the slope, hit it way too hard, hit it about 25 feet past the hole in an area of the green where I'd seen other people putt from and have very little success at all. And sure enough, he hits this putt, double breaking putt, rolls it right in, makes par, keeps his lead. Then they go to 17, two good shots by both he and Mickelson, both miss their putts. Then, of course, Payne drives it in the rough at 18, has to lay up. And then makes that 18 footer with the great reaction that's immortalized there with the statue by the 18th green at Pinehurst number 2. And what I really remember the most, guys, is probably the fact that he said Tracy, his wife, had been watching the telecast the day before when he didn't putt very well and told him he needed to keep his head still and keep his head down longer. And that's what he focused on that final round. And of course, made those two great putts there at 16 and 18.
Sure. I'm going to share a story with Gary. I don't think he's heard this, but I was covering the 1998 U.S. Open out in San Francisco, and Payne finished second, and the USGA wanted me to do an interview with Payne. So they said, could I do it in the USGA car on the way down to the media center? So Payne gets in the car, his mother gets in the car, Janice in the car, I'm in the car. I said, Payne, pretty tough defeat here because he thought he should have won that. And Payne looks right at me. I can still see those steely eyes today. And he says, Bob, I will win the U.S. Open at Pinehurst. End of story.
Wow.
For him to say that in no uncertain terms and then go on to do it like he did, to me, is one of the most amazing miracles that probably ever occurred out on the PGA Tour. But that was like Payne, and Gary knows it, very confident. And when he said something, he definitely was going to do it.
Gary, I'm wondering, look, we all have our stories of how we got started in golf. I was the son of a, I'm the son of a PGA professional. How did you get involved? How'd you get your start in the game? And did you pattern your style, your swing, et cetera, after any particular players of that time?
Well, I got started pretty much by accident. We had moved from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where I was born, to Sarasota, Florida, summer of 1960. So I was 7 years old. I got to town and, of course, didn't know anybody. And my mom decided to take me to the city recreation department on a Wednesday afternoon. Just so happened they were having a golf clinic. It was being run by a gentleman by the name of Pat Hall, who was the PGA professional at the municipal course there in Sarasota, Bobby Jones Municipal. I, for some reason, just loved it right away. The challenge of trying to hit the ball and, you know, and the encouragement from Pat, I think, made a huge difference as well. I continued to play some other sports, Little League baseball and some tennis and all that, but then got pretty serious about golf at probably 12 or 13. I was an only child, and I loved the fact that I could do golf by myself. I could practice by myself. I could play by myself if I couldn't find anyone else to play with. And it just seemed to fit my personality. Did I pattern myself after any one player? Probably not. I was a kind of skinny kid that didn't hit the ball very far growing up, and really had to, kind of rely on a great short game and good putting, which I honed quite a bit there in Sarasota, simply because I could do that for free, and to hit balls, I had to pay money. and I didn't have the money to do that. Certainly, at that time frame, so we're talking, early 60s, the golf that was on TV was really Arnold Palmer golf. I mean, he was kind of the man, and certainly he was the one I looked up to. I knew I'd never play the game the way he played it, but he was certainly the one that I looked up to.
Yeah, you had a successful junior golf career, and then on to not too far from Sarasota over to Gainesville, and what, three-time All-American, I believe, there. You guys, what a powerhouse team you had when you guys won the 73 NCAA team championship. Would you please remind our listeners just how stacked that team was, at least in terms of ability? But I would guess going into that season and the seasons that you were there, you guys had to be confident that you had the group to win just about any time, anywhere.
Well, we did. I was very fortunate to go to the University of Florida at a time when there were a lot of very good players. You have to remember back in that time frame, kind of the early 70s to mid 70s, there really were only about, I would say, five or six colleges that consistently had a chance to win the NCAA. Houston was one, Texas another one, Wake Forest was very good, Oklahoma State was very good, USC had some good teams. But, that grouping were kind of heads and above as most of the other teams. My 4 years that I was there, we finished third, third, first, and second in the NCAA championship. The team you're referencing there in 1973 when we won the championship, Andy Bean was part of that team, multiple winner on the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour. Woody Blackburn, who won a tournament on the PGA Tour. Bill Hancock, who won a tournament on the PGA Tour. Myself, a winner on the PGA Tour. And then a gentleman by the name of Ben Duncan, who has been a longtime successful PGA of America member up in the Panhandle area of Florida. So we were good. We knew it. We had a very successful year that year in 73. We had won the SEC championship and I think like five other tournaments during the course of the year. there. So we went to Oklahoma State, where the NCAA was played. It was an interesting scenario. Laburn Harris Sr. had been the coach at Oklahoma State for many, many years and never won the NCAA championship. So he announced his retirement. So the NCAA decided to let him host the NCAA championship in his last year, I'm assuming giving him every opportunity to finally win one. We were at a barbecue the night before the first round, and the Oklahoma State team was at a table not far from ours. And we heard Laburn Harris say something to the effect of, "We don't need to worry about the guys from Florida. We've got them on our home course." And as if we needed any added motivation, that was it. And we were very fortunate. I think we ended up winning the team title by about 10 shots.
Oh, well. Hey, listen, Gary, you won six times on the PGA Tour. What stands out about that first win at the 76th Tallahassee Open?
Well, Bob, it was just my eighth start on the PGA Tour. I'd gone through the qualifying school in the fall of 1975. And, of course, back then, getting through the school only gave you the right to go out and try to Monday qualify. Fortunately, if you made the cut in an event, you were automatically in the next week. Well, I made all six cuts out on the West Coast, so I got to play every week after qualifying for the first tournament at Tucson, and went to Tallahassee. It was an opposite field event. It was the same week as the Tournament of Champions that was being held out at La Costa. So, you know, the field was minus, obviously, some of the real stars, although Arnold Palmer did play that year, which was quite the scene in Tallahassee to have Arnold Palmer there for 4 days. What do I remember the most? Well, coming down to the final hole, I had a one-shot lead. John Mahaffey, who was a great player, won multiple times on the tour, won a PGA championship, was already in the house. I want to say he was in at 278, 10 under par. I was 11 under playing the final hole. I hit the green about 35 feet from the hole and ran that putt about 6 feet past. And I'm thinking to myself, that wasn't very smart, you know, but I looked at this 6-footer and I just kind of remembered all the times I had practiced 6-foot putts and said, you know what, you've made this putt thousands and thousands of time. You know, there's no reason that you can't make it one more time. And sure enough, I did. And of course, that all of a sudden sets you up to where no more Monday qualifying, you know, you're in any week you wanted to play, which was a real bonus for, you know, rookie on the PGA Tour at that time. First place check, a whopping $16,000. And my wife and I thought we were rich.
Well, you've been rich to a lot of listeners with your broadcasting. How did you get your start in broadcasting?
Another one of those being in the right place at the right time. I had not played particularly well on the tour for almost a year and a half. 1989 was not a very good year, and the beginning of 1990 was not very good either. I was still an exempt player from the win in 1988 at Las Vegas. We were doing our University of Florida golf team fundraiser at Lake Nona in Orlando, and Bob Murphy, who had played for the Gators before me, was now working at ESPN doing the senior tour telecast with Jim Kelly and Jim Colbert. They were just starting to cover golf. And Bob had some arthritis in his hands, had to quit playing and was doing the telecast. He came up to me and he said, "Have you ever thought about doing TV?" And I said, "Bob, right about now, the way I'm playing, I would try anything different." he said, "Well, Jim Colbert has told us that he's turning 50 later this year, and he will be leaving ESPN and go play full-time on the then senior tour. Would you have any interest if I gave your information to the producer, Andy Young, and see if he would like to have you come out and maybe give it a try?" I said, "Yes, that would be great." Well, I kept playing and I didn't hear anything for probably, almost 6 weeks. Finally, I got a call from Andy Young and he said, "I've got five events between now and the end of the year that I could have you come out and we could see if we think you've got any potential, whether you like it or not." I looked at the schedule. Three of those 5 weeks were tournaments that I normally played, had played for years. And being an exempt player, I knew I'd be able to play those. Long discussion with my wife, and we decided that an opportunity back then, especially, there weren't many people that got to talk about golf, ESPN, ABC, and NBC, and that was it. So I made the decision to go ahead and try it. And I liked it immediately. It was a wonderful experience from the standpoint that I felt like you were part of a team. And, you know, you play golf your whole life and the majority of it is you against everybody else. But doing television was truly a team effort, and I just really enjoyed that. They obviously seemed to think that I had some potential. And, you know, after those five events toward the end of 1990, they signed me to a full-time contract in 1991. And all of a sudden, I was now a broadcaster and no longer a player. It was an interesting transition. But I also had to remind myself that I had somebody paying all my expenses from the time I left my front door until the time I got home. And I knew exactly what my schedule was going to be. So there were some real pluses to it. And I took to it right away. Andy Young and Steve Byme, who was the director at the time there at ESPN, were really great in helping me get better. As I look at some of the tapes from my first few shows, and I wasn't very good. But that's not unusual. You know, one of my roles, since I was the guy on the ground, there was only three of us doing the telecast. One of my roles as the guy on the ground was to do the interviews. Well, of course, I'd never asked the questions before. I'd always been the one to answer questions when I played well. About a month in or so, Andy Young called me to his hotel room one night and said, I've put together a lowlight of your interviews, and I want to go over it with you so we can get you better, which was very helpful. And, you know, I learned a lot in a very short period of time, got more and more comfortable. It's like a lot of things. The more you do it, the more comfortable you become. But also, it really helps to have some people helping you along the way.
Gary Coca, very special guest here on Musings on Golf. How does it feel now, Gary, when you're walking in a crowd, more people will say better than most than say, hi, Gary Coke?
Well, you know,
Bob, get a lot of that, Gary. Gary, yeah, you still get a lot of that every day?
Oh, I do. Yeah, I do, especially at golf tournaments. You know, maybe not so much, you know, through airports or something like that, occasionally. But certainly when I'm at a golf tournament, I hear it a lot. And, you know, I'm very fortunate. It was just one of those Tiger moments. Back at a time, it was 2001. It was when Tiger did stuff that nobody else did. And I just happened to be part of one of those moments, very fortunate to be there. And you know, it started to take on, I guess, more a life of its own, maybe 15 years ago or so, when it started being used to promo the players. And, you know, it became, I actually got tired of hearing it, to be perfectly honest with you. At times. But anyway, it, you know, I'm sure it'll be on my tombstone when I depart, but you know, I feel very fortunate to have been part of one of many Tiger moments.
Hey, Gary, did those words just kind of come to you, or had you said
Well,
those
if you
before?
Go back, if you go back and listen to the entire, you know, kind of whole scenario, we set up the putt very well. I had seen some other guys putt from that position on the green earlier in the day, and every one of them had missed the hole to the right and literally putted the ball down into the fringe. We set it up very nicely between Johnny Miller and myself. And then, as Johnny was wont to do back in those days, the ball's left Tiger's putter and hasn't rolled more than about 6 feet. And I hear this, how's that look, Gary? Well, better than most, because it was farther to the left than I'd seen anybody else from that position. So then it started going down the hill, and it was clearly farther left because it was well left of the hole. And again, it was better than most. And then, of course, it went in, and then it really was better than most. So if Johnny hadn't, you know, kind of prompted the whole thing, it probably never would have come out.
Now, on the darker side, Gary, how did it feel when NBC Sports decides to let you and Roger go?
Bob, it was disappointing. Not so much that, you know, you come to the end of a career. I mean, you know, every career comes to an end. I mean, that, and I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, I was going to go on forever covering golf for NBC. I think the most disappointing thing was kind of the way it was handled, not really having any notice that this was going to be the end until, I guess, October of that year. And, you know, David Faraday had left to go to LIV. So an important part of our team was gone, which kind of made me think that maybe I was even a little more valuable since David wasn't going to be there. And you know, to be honest, I think what hurt the most was not having the opportunity to tell a lot of people goodbye and thank you. You know, over 25 years, I worked with some great people at NBC. I developed some great relationships with players and caddies and instructors and PGA Tour officials and tournament directors. And now all of a sudden, you know, you realize that the only time you saw those people were when you were working at a tournament. And I wasn't going to be at tournaments anymore. And, you know, I just felt like I never had the opportunity to to really, you know, express how I felt to a lot of those people, which was probably the most disappointing thing about it. Now, I, you know, tried to text people and call people and all that, but it's not the same as doing it in person. So that was probably the roughest part about it.
Well, we're on the final holes of our time with the great Gary Koch here on Musings on Golf. Hey, Gary, watch any major event, an NFL game, a golf coverage, just the technological, the production, for goodness sakes, that goes into it. It's remarkable. And I think, you know, as fans, we kind of get used to it. It's drones here and this and that. From your perspective, is there one or maybe more technological advancements that stand out to you in terms of golf coverage that is of great benefit to the viewer?
Kelly, I would say probably the number one thing in my mind is the tracer technology. You know, if you go back and watch golf telecasts from, you know, even just 5-6 years ago, most of the time you see a shot struck and then you just see a ball flying through the air and you have no perspective as to where that ball is headed, whether it's going right at the hole, whether it's going to the right of the green, the left of the green, into the water, out of bounds, or whatever. And now having that tracer technology on virtually every shot really gives the viewer a much better perspective of where the ball is headed in relation to where the player wants it to go. So I would think that's probably number one. The other thing that I've enjoyed here fairly recently is the use of the drones. I think, again, it gives the viewer a perspective of the golf course that, you know, we used to have elaborate flyovers and other things, but, you know, they didn't quite capture what the drones are capable of capturing. And, you know, I know some of the players, just a couple of weeks ago there, Bob McIntyre had a little issue with the one at the Canadian Open. And, you know, yeah, they can make a little bit of noise, but, you know, as a player, I have a feeling those things are here to stay, so you better get used to that. But I think those are probably the two biggest things that I see that have helped the viewers experience.
Very final question for me. It's one that I've really enjoyed asking, and we've gotten all kinds of different answers. It's been fun. And very simply, again, is, you know, if you had a dream foursome, if you could have three other people, whether living or deceased, that you could play a sort of a magical round of golf with, who would they be and where would you play?
The grouping would be my late father, the late Arnold Palmer, and my longtime friend, Walker Cup teammate and agent, Vinny Giles, who former U.S. amateur champion, senior amateur champion, British amateur champion. The reason why I named those are probably the three most influential people in my golfing life. You know, my dad's the one who kind of got me started and kept me interested early on. I mentioned earlier that Arnold was kind of my hero growing up. I was very fortunate, A, to win his tournament, B, to play with him a number of times. He was always great with counsel as to how you should conduct yourself as a professional golfer. And then Vinny, having been my agent and manager for since literally 1975, when I turned professional, always kind of instilled in me that, you know, you treat people the way you'd like to be treated, you know, that all these deals that are done should be beneficial to both parties. There shouldn't be a one-way street, you know, in a contract. You need to give a little to get a little, that type thing. So, you know, those three would be, again, the most influential in my golfing life. Where would we go play? Well, Mr. Bubka, I would go to Shinnecock. I like it that much.
Yes.
People ask me all the time, your favorite golf course. I always tell people that, you know, talking about golf courses and rating them is a lot like art. You know, you look at a picture and go, wow. I look at the same picture and go, huh? Shinnecock, to me, I could play day in and day out. I absolutely love it. I feel like every time I play there, I hit every club in my bag. Weather conditions play in a part of how it plays, how difficult. But it's just really a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Well, let me brag a little, Gary Koch. I was invited to a member guest at Shinnecock. I had a 2 handicap. I shot 67 on the final round of the member guest, and we win. That phone into the USGA was off the hook. People were insisting, no way a 2 handicapper is going to come and shoot 3 under par at Shinnecock. But it was just that magical day where everything went in, every drive, instead of a bad bounce, it got a good bounce, and a round I certainly will never forget.
That makes two of us then, because I've had a couple of good days at Shinnecock as well.
Gary, thank you so much for doing this. You're a special person, and you've been a very special guest.
Well, Bob, it's been a pleasure. Kelly, great being with you guys, and let's enjoy a great U.S. Open week.
Now, Gary, do you have a pick? Anybody who is it the obvious in Scheffler? Or who do you think?
Yeah, you know, I mean, when you think about Pinehurst number two and the fact that it's a second shot golf course and you have to have a good short game, I mean, everything points towards Scottie Scheffler, right? I guess he's number one in a strokes gained approach, and he's about fifth in strokes gained around the green. But I'm gonna pick Deki Matsuyama.
Ah.
He is number one in strokes gained around the green, and he's in the top 30 in strokes gained approach for the year. So, and he seems to have the patience necessary to play that place, and he's a major champion. So I'm looking for him to have a good week.
I'm getting on a plane to Las Vegas as soon as we finish.
Hey, Gary, great to have you back, and thanks for all your time and reminiscences here on Musings on Golf. Greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure, guys.
Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. Folks, I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry. Yeah, I think the U.S. Open is enriched, certainly for viewers on NBC Sports and Peacock and USA Network, with having Gary Koch on. What a really good man. Heck of a golfer himself, Bob. You never really know that. You talked a little bit about his golf game, but he's certainly better than most.
Speaking of better than most, Gary Koch did win 6 times on the PGA Tour. And if you want to be a winner, you got to put a pair of William & Harry shoes on. They are simply the best. I took them with me out to the east end of Long Island, went to the East Hampton Golf Club, a very prestigious club designed by Ben Crenshaw and Bill Kaur. Took them in the pro shop, and the pro was amazed at the quality. I wouldn't be surprised in the future we're going to see some members of the East Hampton Golf Club walking around in their latest William & Harry golf shoe, simply the best on the market.
Now, I wore them out in Vegas, my 2 rounds out there. Great-looking shoes. The Viper, and very, very comfortable. We encourage everybody, go to williamandharry.com. And when you place your order there, put in the discount code 10OFF, M-O-G. That's the number 10, the word off, and then M-O-G, which, Bob, stands for Musings on Golf. Hey, we thank Gary Koch very much, Bob. Next week, as a third installment this year, Bob, of our roundtable recap of major golf championships, we welcome another member of the NBC Sports Golf team, John Wood, caddy turned excellent analyst. We're going to have a lot of fun with John. He's good, and he's going to bring a lot more insight, Bob, into what viewers see this week at Pinehurst. And on behalf of Bob, myself, and Janice, everybody involved in Musings on Golf, happy Father's Day week. I know all the fathers and the mothers, I'm sure, and the kids are going to be watching final round of the 124th United States Open Golf Championship on Sunday in Pinehurst number 2. Enjoy. Doesn't get too much better. Kelly Elbin, Musings on Golf, signing off for my good buddy Bob Bupka. Talk to you next week.